Hopkins had brought in to screen proposed projects, they had to confess that the blueprints weren't ready, or the specifications weren't ready, or the topographical surveys weren't ready. LaGuardia watched many of them walk out of the conference humiliated and without the money they were asking for. But he had blueprints, he had specifications, he had topographical surveys. He had every piece of paper that even the hardest eye Army engineer could desire, and he had them because of Moses. Other municipalities were so unequal to the task of planning public works programs of size that in October 1938, the WPA would cancel more than 100 major grants approved for 11 northeastern cities 3 years before because the blueprints for those projects were still not ready. But Moses' engineers would come walking up the front steps of City Hall with blueprints piled high in their arms. President Roosevelt's friendship was indispensable to LaGuardia's dreams, but no more indispensable than the tools Moses gave him to make use of it. And Moses, the skillful manipulator of men, found plenty in LaGuardia to manipulate. There was, for example, the mayor's boundless enthusiasm for engineering and engineers. Moses played on this feeling. He was constantly pressing LaGuardia to accompany him on inspection tours of construction sites, and, with his great gift for words, his sense of drama, and his squads of engineers who would follow the mayoral limousine in a second car so that they could leap out at a project site, elaborate artists' renderings in hand, and show the mayor what the project would look like when completed, he made these tours wonderfully exciting to a man who stood like a child in front of the simplest engineering feat. Once, the little mayor was so anxious to see the work on the Thomas Jefferson Park swimming pool that when he found the gate locked and no one around to open it, he chinned himself on the fence like a little boy so that he could see over the top. "I could always tell when Moses had been taking him around," Windels recalls. "He would be absolutely bubbling over with enthusiasm. He was just thrilled." If Moses was putting on one of the greatest engineering shows in the history of civilization, moreover, he made sure LaGuardia had a ringside seat. For example, on the day that the 2,200-ton vertical lift span that comprised the Harlem River arm of the Triborough Bridge was to be set into place, the mayor was standing on Randall's Island in the very shadow of the tower that, along with its twin on the Manhattan shore, would hold the span. And when the span was finally set in place, he said breathlessly, "This is the most thrilling moment I have had since I became mayor. I congratulate the authority, the engineers, the contractors, and every man who has had a part in this magnificent piece of work. Moments like this make up for many heartaches and disappointments." The fact, which astonished him when he learned it, that Moses had never gone to engineering school did not prevent him from gushing on several occasions, "Robert Moses is the greatest engineer in the world." He wanted Moses' admiration. He was jealous of the only man who really had it. Moses recalls that, "When the mayor was mad at me, which was not infrequent, he would say, 'The only boss you ever had whom you really respected was Al Smith. What's he got that I don't have?'" Moses recalls that, "I always answered that I admired both of them, but thought Smith a better executive because he always stood behind his subordinates." LaGuardia's predilection for pageantry, preferably with himself at its center, was obvious to anyone who noticed the yards of gold braid with which the mayor outfitted his policeman bodyguard, or his penchant for holding full-dress military-type inspections of anything that could conceivably be inspected. Police or firemen with motorized equipment, snow plows, new garbage trucks, old garbage trucks, and for preening and strutting as he marched in front of them, literally swelling out his barrel chest as he bounced by at the salute. Moses played on this predilection. He gave the major pageantry such as no mayor had ever enjoyed in democratic America. Moses was opening playgrounds at a fantastic rate. 60 in 1934, 71 in 1935, 72 in 1936, 52 in 1937. LaGuardia was present at most opening ceremonies. And these were ceremonies with the Moses touch. For the opening of a small playground on 17th Street between 8th and 9th Avenues, for example, Nearby tenements were draped in red, white, and blue. Not crepe paper streamers, but immense triangular pennons. Flower pots containing 25,000 chrysanthemums made a bright ring around the playground fence. Flags were everywhere. The whole scene gleamed with the reflection of the hot summer sunlight off the polished bridles and curried satiny flanks of mounted policemen's horses, the polished brass and buttons of platoons of green-clad Park Department guards, the trumpets and tubas of Park Department and American Legion bands. As the mayor's limousine pulled up to the curb between rows of rigidly erect policemen at the salute, a smartly uniformed Park Department guard swung open its door, and as the mayor bounced out, followed by the gold braid of his bodyguard, the bands broke into a tune. Incredibly, Hail to the Chief. And when he reached the white-painted, bunting-draped speaker's platform, he found he was the only speaker, except for Moses, who confined himself to a very brief recitation of playground statistics, and then said, "I now introduce the mayor of the city of New York," a performance that led LaGuardia to comment later that Moses was the ideal master of ceremonies. At the precise instant at which the applause passed its crescendo and began to fade away after LaGuardia's speech, which had been delivered at a lectern custom-built by Park Department carpenters so that the little mayor wouldn't be forced to stretch to reach the microphone, it was punctuated by a hiss as the center fountain in the wading pool was turned on full blast, dramatically filling the air with sprays of water and eliciting a gratifying ooh from hundreds of children waiting behind a ribbon. And when the mayor advanced to cut the ribbon and allow the children to rush into the spray, he found that it was no ordinary ribbon, but a braided and tasseled strand colored red, white, and blue, and the shears held out to him by a little girl from the neighborhood were sterling silver shears resting on a cushion of royal purple velvet. Then the mayor jumped back into his limousine for a trip that was an adventure in itself. Fiorella LaGuardia's dashes across the city, limousine siren wailing, police on motorcycles clearing the path, were not trips for the faint-hearted. And when the mayor arrived at the other playgrounds, he found again chrysanthemums, flags, men on horseback, polished brass and buttons, bands, Hail to the Chief, every detail that had made the first opening so exciting, plus often new inspirations. At a playground being opened in Brooklyn's Red Hook section, whose most famous landmark was the Gowanus House, around which a Revolutionary War battle had been fought, a large painting of the Gowanus House had been placed as a backdrop behind the speaker's platform. The neighborhood was predominantly Italian, and as the mayor walked onto the platform, two aerial bombs were shot into the air, releasing parachutes that floated above the playground site, and attached to one parachute was an American flag, to the other, the tricolor of the House of Savoy. On some days, LaGuardia would open as many as 15 playgrounds scattered across the face of the great city, turning the occasion into a triumphal tour of his domain, speeding behind his helmeted outriders across the reaches of the bridge-connected boroughs, and then leaping into a launch to bring his presence even to the colony on Staten Island. Each ceremony would be perfect in every detail, or almost every detail. At one dedication in an Italian neighborhood, held before Moses was acquainted with LaGuardia's views on organ grinders, Moses had several, along with their hurdy-gurdies and monkeys, on hand to entertain the children, and LaGuardia sat on the platform glowering out from under the brim of his big hat. And the pageantry Moses arranged for the little flower was not limited to playground openings. It included the annual Christmas tree lighting ceremony in City Hall Park, complete with a program of instrumental music and carol singing and a switch that the mayor threw to light up a 60-foot spruce. It included the dedication of the baseball diamond complex in Alley Pond Park, at which LaGuardia, after a series of fantastic contortions on the pitcher's mound, got to throw the first pitch to a batter who happened to be Babe Ruth. The Bambino, swinging with something less than his usual gusto, possibly because he was almost doubled over with laughter, hit a pop fly that dropped to the ground in the vicinity of second base. Moses made a place for LaGuardia in every major Park Department event. 1936, Fortune magazine said in an article about Moses, was the swimming pool year. The 10 giant neighborhood swimming pools were completed that summer, and Moses opened one a week for 10 weeks. Of a size previously unimagined in swimming pools, one was 330 feet long and 160 feet wide, they brought the joys of swimming to city-bound children and parents by the tens of thousands. Moses' passion for swimming led him to take a special interest in these pools, and he drove the engineers responsible for their design to invent filtering plants of new efficiency and underwater lighting that made them revolutionary developments in recreation. Harry Hopkins called the Astoria Pool the finest pool in all the world. And Moses exerted all his genius as a showman to make each opening the most memorable event in the history of the neighborhood in which it was located. A parade led by local political leaders and local American Legion, high school, and Knights of Columbus bands would wind through the neighborhood beforehand, generally in the early evening, since the openings were held at night, so that the underwater lighting would be more spectacular, attracting tens of thousands of residents. After neighborhood priests had blessed the clear waters, chlorinated, of the pools, there would be swimming races and diving competitions by neighborhood youngsters, and by Olympic stars imported from all over the United States, as well as exhibitions by a team of swimming clowns. Each opening, moreover, would be tailored to the neighborhood in which the pool was located. Believing that what Negroes liked to do most was dance and sing, Moses arranged that the opening ceremonies for the Colonial Park Pool in Harlem include an exhibition by Bojangles Bill Robinson, identified by the Times as a Negro tap dancer, a rendition of the Battle Hymn of the Republic by Negro tenor Roland Hayes, accompanied by the 369th Regiment Band, and community singing. But center stage at each opening was reserved for Fiorello H. LaGuardia. It was he who pulled the switch that turned on the underwater lighting, an event that never failed to bring a murmur of oohs from the crowd. It was he who gave the word to raise the flag, and it was he who got to cut the ribbon and shout to the waiting children, "Okay, kids, it's all yours." Moses saw to it that one playground at the Williamsburg Bridge Plaza was named the Fiorello H. LaGuardia Playground. "The best thing about this playground is its name," he wrote the mayor. If there were personal reasons why the mayor wanted to allow Moses his independence, there were political reasons why he had to. The most important, of course, was public opinion and Moses' hold on it. Already predisposed to be friendly toward Moses because he was creator and defender of parks, the city's 13 daily newspapers had that friendship cultivated with customary Moses thoroughness. As always, he went directly to the top, giving newspaper owners pre-opening tours of new bridges and free passes to them thereafter, inviting them to sail on the Long Island Park Commission's yacht, bathe in the reserved section of Jones Beach, and dine in the private section of the Marine Dining Room, where he served them lavish helpings of his inimitable charm. Iphigene and Arthur Sulzberger of the Times, Helen and Ogden Mills Reed of the Herald Tribune, who never found out about Moses' plan to deceive him into making a contribution to the Yale University Minor Sports Association, and Roy W. Howard of the World Telegram regarded him as a personal friend. He spent many weekends at their summer homes. Moses also lavished attention on top editors. He had easy access to the Herald Tribunes because his Yale classmate Harold Phelps Stokes was one of them, and he used that access. One of the Tribune's editors was a dyed-in-the-wool reactionary who saw Bolsheviks in every bush, and Moses helped his vision, filling the editor's mail with leaflets mimeographed by left-wingers in the WPA to prove that any dissension among WPA workers in the park department was fomented by communists. The chief editorial writer of the Times was Charles Mertz, a Yale graduate who lived in the apartment building next to Moses. "Just by happenstance," remarks Joseph C. Ingraham, a Times reporter and later its transportation editor, who became friendly with Moses, "Moses would be waiting in the lobby of Mertz's apartment house many mornings to ask him if he wanted a lift downtown so he could plant an editorial." And while Moses went to the top, he did not stop there, wining and dining reporters as well as publishers, inviting key ones to his elaborate opening ceremony luncheons, to an annual swimming and dinner outing at Jones Beach, to more intimate and elaborate luncheons at Belmont Lake State Park, to the Park Department's Christmas party at the Arsenal, and to day-long yacht trips, which often ended with clam and lobster bakes on Fire Island. At all these events, the food was superb, the liquor flowed freely, and so did the charm. The most important newspaper in the city, and in the country, was the New York Times, and Moses had an especially strong hold over the Times. The devotion to parks of the woman who owned approximately two-thirds of its voting stock. Iphigenie Oak Sulzberger, only living child of the imperious little patriarch of the Times, who during the 1920s had purchased key parcels in Saratoga and reserved them for Moses State Park there, had been fighting for years for the expansion and improvement of New York City's inadequate and decaying park system, a fight whose frustrations were summed up in one conversation with Tammany Manhattan Park Commissioner Sheehy, who unabashedly told her to her face that until he became commissioner, he had never been in Central Park in his life. When LaGuardia told her that he was giving Robert Moses power over parks, she had been happy, and the adjective had proved inadequate to describe her feelings about what Moses was accomplishing with that power. Elected president of the city's Park Association in January 1935, Iphigenie Sulzberger's first official act was to present Moses with the association's annual testimonial award, and, as she handed him the illuminated scroll, she said earnestly, "Commissioner Moses, you have made us feel that the projects for which we have striven can be realized." She would serve as president until 1963, heading the Park Association, therefore, for 25 of the 26 years that Moses served as city park commissioner, and during all that time, her admiration for him would only increase. In 1963, the association would present him with another illuminated scroll. It closed with the words, "How wondrous are his works, how deep our gratitude." In private, moreover, Mrs. Sulzberger was, if possible, even more adulatory. In 1967, standing by a window in her Fifth Avenue apartment, looking out over Central Park, the gray-haired, dignified woman would tell the author, "There has never been as great a public servant. He was a man of vision, a giant. He saw nature as a whole. I had a feeling that he liked to fight, that if someone just agreed with him, he was disappointed. He liked to beat them. He was a hero of old, always rushing into battle with Excalibur waving above his head. I thought of the Park Association as Aaron and Hur. Do you know who Aaron and Hur were? They were the soldiers in the Bible who stood behind Moses and held up his arms when he got tired at the Battle of Rephidim, at which Israel prevailed, so long as Moses held up his hands. Well, that's how I thought of the Park Association, as upholding the arms of Bob Moses." Not that she always agreed with him. Mrs. Sulzberger possessed, years earlier than most urban planners, a very acute understanding that the values of engineers were not compatible with the values for which parks were created. "Engineers are straight-line crazy," she would tell the interviewer. She didn't want the unspoiled wilderness of Inwood Hill Park destroyed by the running of a road on a straight line along its crest. A believer in the old theory that the purpose of parks was primarily conservation, not recreation, although she might not have stated the theory in precisely those terms, she didn't like the idea that Moses' plans required the covering over of so many green spaces with concrete for playgrounds, basketball courts, and other active play facilities, not to mention roads and parking fields. In particular, believing in the preservation of Central Park as a restful retreat from the abrasions of city life, she didn't want so many active play facilities there. "Iphigenie gave us many arguments," Jack Madigan said, "and," he said, "some we walked away from," a euphemism meaning they surrendered. Moses probably turned the abandoned reservoir site in Central Park into a great lawn instead of into the playgrounds and ball fields that he originally wanted there, solely because of Mrs. Sulzberger's feelings. But while Moses may have walked away from some fights with Mrs. Sulzberger, he did not walk away from many. He would not allow, because of his nature he could not allow, anybody, even an individual whose support was so important to him, to criticize his plans. His usual technique with Mrs. Sulzberger was not to walk away, but to walk with, to take her himself, or have Madigan or Andrews take her, on a tour of the area in dispute, to try to sell her on his idea of how it should be developed. These walks were planned with care. Madigan took her to Inwood Hill on a weekday when the park was deserted and told her that the public wasn't getting any use out of it, guessing correctly that she had never hiked up the steep hill on a weekend and hence had not seen the happy picnickers who crowded it then. Madigan also played shrewdly on her sensibilities, which were firmly Victorian. I told Iphigene if you walked up there at night you were likely to step on a couple, and it might be a good idea to have lights, the headlights from cars, you know, up there. And the walks usually worked, particularly since Moses' opponents did not know her well enough to take her on walks themselves and show her their side of the argument, and did not have the facilities or manpower to compile the facts and figures that might have disproved Moses' facts and figures. Moses persuaded Mrs. Sulzberger to persuade the Park Association to elect Andrews, a native Virginian who could be as courtly with women as he could be curt with men. Mrs. Sulzberger says he was a remarkable man, to its board of directors, and thereafter there was someone working for association support of his policies from within. Mrs. Sulzberger's dedication to the cause of parks was so complete, moreover, that she didn't want to do anything that would interfere drastically with what Moses was doing, even if she felt he was sometimes wrong. This man was rejuvenating parks at a rate she would never have believed possible. She didn't want him hampered by her disagreement with what she regarded as details. "I never did like the concrete floors on the playgrounds," she would tell the interviewer. But, she would note, before Moses came along, there were no real playgrounds at all. No swings and no jungle gyms. Hardly anything for children to play on, really. So sincere was Mrs. Sulzberger's dedication to parks and the new park commissioner that this proud and dignified woman even submitted to a public insult, quite possibly the only one she ever received, at his hands. The quarrel was based on Moses' plan to turn the site of the demolished Central Park Casino into a playground. Mrs. Sulzberger had allowed herself to be reconciled to the creation of perimeter playgrounds in Central Park by Moses' argument that small children could not be kept out of the park anyway, and the strategic placing of playgrounds next to park entrances would intercept them and confine their destructive energy to the park's edge. She had never thought that Moses would begin to lay concrete in the park's interior. Hearing of the plan for the casino site, she protested publicly on behalf of the Park Association in a letter released to the press on December 23, 1935, in which she stated, "It seems to me that in our desire to establish playgrounds, which are sadly needed in the city, we are completely overlooking the rights and needs of the adult population. Central Park will fail to fulfill its purpose if there is no longer space where men and women can have quiet and relaxation." Moses' letter of reply, which he released to the press on December 24th, closed with the words, "Merry Christmas." But the rest of the letter was couched in the tone Moses customarily employed with protesters. "Your arguments," he informed Mrs. Sulzberger, "are preposterous and irresponsible generalizations. It is difficult for me to believe that you seriously contend that the needs of the adult population are being completely overlooked in our parks." The letter even closed with a threat. "This particular question does not seem to me to be important enough to quarrel about, unless you insist on proving your generalizations, in which case I am prepared to refute them by a public exhibition of plans, photographs, maps, and supporting figures." It would have been interesting to see how the Times, which buried the exchange of letters on page 25, would have covered such an exhibition. But there was to be no need for one. Mary Moses saw to that. A week later, the Sulzbergers and the Moseses were among the guests at the dance given every New Year's Eve by the Jewish Gatsby, Adolf Lewison, in the great gold-and-white ballroom of his Fifth Avenue mansion. Mrs. Sulzberger recalls that Mary came over leading Bob by the hand like a little boy, and she said, "You know Iphigenie's a good friend. You had no business writing her a letter like that. Now you tell her you're sorry and you kiss her." Moses told her he was sorry and kissed her. And at 2 a.m., when the Sulzbergers, as was their custom every New Year's Eve, served friends a scrambled egg breakfast at their apartment, the Moseses were there, as usual. Mrs. Sulzberger had too deep a sense of her responsibility to the public to take the insulting letter personally anyway. Robert Moses was too valuable to the city to quarrel with, she felt. And, she was to tell the interviewer, it was unappreciative to quarrel with a man who had done so much for New York. On the day after the New Year's breakfast, in an act of selflessness made all the more noble by the fact that her power made it unnecessary for her to perform it, Iphigenie Oakes Sulzberger, sacrificing her pride on the altar of what she believed to be the public interest, wrote a public apology to Moses and ordered it printed in her own newspaper. "I owe you an apology for having said that we are completely overlooking the rights and needs of the adult population. No such sweeping generalization is warranted. I do, however, believe that we are in danger of paying too little attention to those rights and needs." You close your characteristically vigorous defense of the Park Department's plans with the remark that the issues raised in this particular controversy do not seem to you to be important enough to quarrel about. I and other members of the Park Association would dislike greatly any occasion for quarrel with you. You come close to our ideal of what a park commissioner should be, and we have no desire to be associated, even for a moment, with those who have attempted from time to time to hinder you in your plans for the rehabilitation and development of the parks. Mrs. Sulzberger's influence on the newspaper of which her father had been, and her husband was, publisher, was not overt. Intrusiveness was not her style, which was so reasonable, dignified, and soft-spoken that people sometimes mistook her gentleness for timidity. But, as the Times historian Gay Talese has pointed out, no perceptive editor made this mistake. "Her most casual remark," wrote Turner Catledge, later managing editor, "would be treated as a command." Mrs. Sulzberger believed that Moses came close to our ideal of what a park commissioner should be. The Times evidently believed so too. Its reporters and editors may never have been directly ordered to give Moses special treatment, but during the 30s as during the 20s, they were not so insensitive as not to know what was expected of them. Moses' press releases were treated with respect, being given prominent treatment and often being printed in full. There was no investigating of the facts presented in those press releases, no attempt at detailed analysis of his theories of recreation and transportation, no probing of the assumptions on which the city was building and maintaining recreational facilities and roads. The Times ran more than 100 editorials on Moses and his programs during the 12-year LaGuardia administration, overwhelmingly favorable editorials. Once, trying in desperation to make sure that Mrs. Sulzberger got to hear both sides of an issue, LaGuardia invited her to visit his office to hear Moses argue with the official with whom he was currently feuding, City WPA Administrator Victor Ritter. She was not the only female present. The mayor, for some reason, possibly to create a homey atmosphere, had his adopted daughter Jean, then 8 years old, in the office too, and she sat on his knee during the ensuing discussion. LaGuardia's ploy worked. At the end of a shouting match between Moses and Ritter, they really went at it for a while, Mrs. Sulzberger would recall. The mayor ruled against Moses, and for once there was no Times editorial disagreeing with the decision the next day. But such a ploy could obviously not be repeated in every dispute, and in most disputes, Moses could count on the Times' support. Dramatic proof of how popular the press had made Moses was, moreover, available to the mayor every time he spoke in public. Just as audiences reacted with Pavlovian predictability to every mention of Brooklyn, with laughs, so they reacted with Pavlovian predictability to every mention of Robert Moses, with cheers. At the end of a playground opening, there was almost invariably a 2-4-6-8 who do we appreciate for Moses. LaGuardia wanted to fire him often, but he didn't dare, says mayoral law secretary Kern. The press, the New York Times in particular, had babied him like a spoiled child. He couldn't do anything wrong in their eyes. They made him a myth, and a man who had to go to the electorate couldn't fire a myth. He, Moses, was too big to fire. Occasionally, Wendells would try to brace the mayor to stand up to Moses, but on those occasions, the little flower would wail, "What'll the Times say?" If from a personal viewpoint it is not too much to say that LaGuardia liked Moses, from a political viewpoint it is not too much to say that he feared him. At the beginning of his mayoralty, LaGuardia attempted to take an interest in the park department. When he received protests about Moses' plans for a local playground from a local organization, he would grant its representatives an interview, and if he felt their arguments had merit, he would ask Moses to reconsider. When some individual protested about a park department policy or about alleged mistreatment by a park department employee, he would send the protest to Moses with a pink slip attached, a slip that in the color code set up by LaGuardia to govern his relationship with his commissioners meant the mayor wanted an immediate reply. But Moses would either ignore the pink slip or would reply by saying that the mayor must learn to stop interfering in the internal affairs of the park department. "My policies can't be carried out if the mayor is going to listen to appeals from individuals," he would write. And if LaGuardia sought to press an inquiry, Moses would threaten to resign or take the issue to the public. "If you disagreed with Moses, why, you were a public enemy," Wendells said. The mayor had no choice but to let Moses have his way. By the end of his first term, LaGuardia was letting Moses have it. The Astoria Ferry and playground closing fights, which became public knowledge, were exceptions. Most of the disagreements between the mayor and the commissioner were kept secret, because LaGuardia did not press them. When one threatened to become public, the mayor quickly backed down. He and Moses had been arguing over a 25-acre tract of land in Coney Island, owned by the dock department but unused. Moses wanted all the land for a park. The mayor was in favor of a Board of Education plan to use a few of the acres for a school. When he imprudently mentioned to reporters that the location of a school on the border of a park is ideal, the reporters went to Moses for comment. "I thought this administration wanted playgrounds. Either they do or they don't," he said. And he added what the Herald Tribune called some even more uncomplimentary remarks about the mayor. LaGuardia hastily scrambled for cover. "I can't believe my park commissioner made any such statements," the mayor said. "No controversy exists, and none can be made out of it." And the school idea was dropped. "He didn't want to fight with Moses no matter what," Lazarus says. As long as he didn't fight, LaGuardia had learned, Moses would provide him with a seemingly inexhaustible cornucopia of political benefits. If he did fight, Moses would humiliate and defeat him. The little mayor had learned, the hard way, that it was better not to interfere. Other political considerations which deterred the mayor from interfering with Moses in the fields he had carved out for his own were the same reasons that had deterred a governor, Roosevelt, from interfering. Moses' ability to complete public works fast enough to provide a record of accomplishment for an elected official to run on in the next election. His ability to build public works without scandal. His willingness to serve as a lightning rod to draw off opposition from the elected official. Most of all, perhaps, his matchless knowledge of government. Says Judge Jacob Lutsky, who not only served in the LaGuardia administration, but was a top advisor to Mayors O'Dwyer, Impellitteri, and Wagner, "You've got to understand, every morning when a mayor comes to work, there are 100 problems that must be solved, and a lot of them are so big and complex that they just don't seem susceptible to solution. And when he asks guys for solutions, what happens? Most of them can't give him any, and those that do come up with solutions, the solutions are unrealistic or impractical or just plain stupid. And those that do make sense, there's no money to finance them. but you give a problem to Moses, and overnight he's back in front of you with a solution, all worked out down to the last detail, drafts of speeches you can give to explain it to the public, drafts of press releases for the newspapers, drafts of the state laws you'll need to get passed, advice as to who should introduce the bills in the legislature and what committees they should go to, drafts of any city council and board of estimate resolutions you'll need. If there are constitutional questions involved, a list of the relevant precedents, and a complete method of financing it all spelled out. He had solutions when no one else had solutions. A mayor needs a Robert Moses. But there were new reasons, too, why LaGuardia found it politically unfeasible to interfere with Moses. And these reasons had the deepest and most ominous significance for the city. Some revolved around the federal government's newly expanded role in the city's affairs. Always before, the city and the city alone had had the power to determine the priority, location, and design of public works, because the city and the city alone had been paying for them. Every step in the construction of a school or a bridge or a park, from the initial preliminary study of the project's engineering feasibility to the final use of the power of eminent domain to evict citizens to make way for it, had to be authorized by the city government, by officials elected by the city's people. Therefore, those people retained ultimate control over the public works that did so much to shape their lives. The correspondence between their will and public works was, of course, not at all exact. Innumerable factors, chief among them perhaps the corruption that under Tammany Hall interposed private gain as an integral factor in the governmental equation, bent off its bias the great drive shaft of the engine of city government, the drive shaft that, according to the blueprint for that engine, the city charter, was supposed to be turnable only by the public will. But there was a correspondence. A mayor strong enough to dominate the boards of estimate and aldermen would disturb the balance of the drive shaft, which was meant to rest equally on executive and legislative action. But because the mayor was an official elected by and ultimately responsible to the people, the crucial correspondence still existed. But although the city's new mayor was dominating the city's government, that mayor was not controlling the construction of public works in the city to a similar extent. Not the city, but the federal government was paying for the bulk of those public works, and the federal government was much more interested in speed, in getting something to show for its expenditure, than in the considerations that would at least partially motivate a mayor, priorities, location, and design, for example. And because speed of construction depended on the existence of detailed plans, the federal authorities were therefore primarily interested in such plans. Because the mayor needed plans, and needed them fast, he had no choice but to give priority not to those projects which were most urgently needed, but to those projects for which plans were available. And to a considerable extent, not he, but Robert Moses, decided which projects those would be. Because not he, but Moses had the large, stable planning force of engineers trained to design urban public works on the new, huge scale made necessary by the growth of the city and made financially feasible by the new federal involvement, to a considerable extent, he could not even evaluate those plans. He could not argue intelligently for changes in the location or the design Moses was proposing. Continually, LaGuardia sought to overcome this handicap. He was always prodding other departments to come up with plans, Windles recalls, but it took them so long. And when the plans were available, the labor often was not. Moses' stake-driving tactics had tied it up on park department projects. Moses' popularity, moreover, made it all but impossible for the mayor to snatch the labor back. The convenient symbol of LaGuardia's frustration was the firehouses the mayor had wanted to build with the 5,000 men he had authorized the WPA to detach from park department projects in 1937, the 5,000 men he was unable to detach after Moses forced him to back down by locking the playgrounds. The mayor had 20 new firehouses in mind. He was able to build 3. But firehouses were only a symbol. Schoolhouses, jailhouses, and police station houses were also involved, as were hospitals, sewage disposal plants, sewers, and subways. LaGuardia was forced to cut back his planned programs of construction of almost every type of municipal institution except parks, Robert Moses Parks, and bridges, Robert Moses Bridges, and roads, Robert Moses Roads. The lion's share of the billion-plus dollars poured into New York City by the New Deal was spent on Moses projects. To a considerable extent, in the planning of large-scale public works in New York City during the 1930s, Robert Moses operated independently of the elected official who had appointed him, and therefore independently of the people's will. The significance of this fact for the development of New York is heightened by the amount of federal money involved. Even during the flush years of the Jimmy Walker era, New York's expenditures for capital improvements had run only slightly above $100 million per year. That figure represented, in dollars, the annual alteration, hopefully for the better, to the civic estate. But during the first 5 years of the LaGuardia era, the federal government, through CWA, WPA, and PWA, contributed more than $1.15 billion for public works in the city, a figure which, when combined with the city's own expenditures, which LaGuardia was, by 1936, able to restore to the Walkerian level, meant that during those 5 years, the civic estate was altered more than it had been altered in the preceding 15, that New York was able to effect a far greater and more rapid alteration in its physical public structure than had ever before been possible. And this magnified Moses' influence on the city's destiny. The portion of its remaking carried out independently of the people's will was relatively immense. Then there were other political deterrents to any interference with Moses by LaGuardia. Some were a result of the continuation and acceleration of Moses' evolution from scorner of politicians. The legislature hadn't changed much since the days when Robert Moses had been denouncing its corruption and avarice. But Robert Moses had changed. No longer did he respond to a legislator's patronage request by telling him to stick it up your ass. The state park system was a vast reservoir of jobs, both year-round jobs and, because of the seasonal nature of park work, summer jobs particularly coveted by politicians who wanted their teenage children to earn good money in the open air during school vacations. And because the reservoir had outlets, parks, in every corner of the state, Moses had jobs to distribute not only on Long Island, but in the undeveloped, job-poor upstate counties in which the leaders of the Republican legislative majority lived. There was a line, firmly drawn, above which patronage was not allowed to intrude into the state park system. Top administrators, the elite cadre known as Moses men, still had to work their way up from the ranks, still were promoted strictly on the basis of ability and willingness to work killing hours, and still owed their allegiance solely to Robert Moses. But Moses had proved more than willing to fill lower echelon jobs with people recommended by key legislators. As for lucrative construction contracts, the one-time idealist had become known in Albany, according to Saul Kaplan, counsel to Assembly Minority Leader Erwin Steingut, as a practical fellow who understands the facts of life and what makes things tick, a fellow who is prepared to cooperate with anybody. There was a point at which cooperation stopped, the point at which it would interfere with the completion of a project as Moses had originally envisioned it. He employed practical politics only to further his dreams. He did not allow it to interfere with them. Sometimes someone would ask him for something and it would interfere with what he wanted to do, and in that case, he'd say it couldn't be done, Kaplan says. But as long as you weren't a pig, okay. If you put a gun to his head and said either or, he'd tell you to go to hell. But if you laid the cards on the table and didn't try to kid him, he'd help if he could. And if he said you could help him in solving a couple of problems, you helped. This influence was increased by Moses' ideological compatibility with the key upstate or old guard Republican legislators. He was a conservative, and they were conservatives, Wendell said simply. They distrusted LaGuardia, whom they considered a wild man and a traitor to their party, a liberal using its label to get elected. They were infuriated by the mayor's all-out support of FDR and by his general disloyalty, Although he would be elected mayor 3 times on the Republican ticket, not once during his 12 years in that office would LaGuardia ever support a Republican candidate for a state or national office. But because of the legislature's broad control over the city, LaGuardia constantly needed favors from it. Moses' influence with it could therefore be an asset to him, if Moses wanted to use that influence on his behalf. Conversely, the possibility that Moses would use that influence against him was a very real threat. At least once, an inoffensive bill that LaGuardia had thought would be passed routinely was inexplicably held up in committee while he was embroiled in one of his disputes with Moses, and, although he never received any proof that his park commissioner was behind the holdup, the mayor received hints that he was, and saw it as Moses' way of letting him know what Moses could do to him in Albany if he wanted to. Whether or not Moses actually used his power with the legislature for or against LaGuardia, he made himself in many instances the broker between the mayor and the legislative leaders, often acting as middleman in closed-door bargaining sessions. Moses' power in state government therefore increased his power over the city government, to which he, alone among state officials, also belonged, to a point where it drastically eroded the ability of the city's highest elected official, technically his superior, to control him. This, of course, was precisely what the framers of the state's constitution, and many reformers, had feared when they sought to prohibit the simultaneous holding of state and city jobs by the same individual. But the reformers had sacrificed the principle because they believed that Moses' unique abilities should exempt him from normal considerations, and because LaGuardia had assured them that his power as mayor made such a prohibition unnecessary. An appointed official not directly responsible to the electorate could never obtain power to defy the official who was responsible for his appointment, the mayor had said. But Moses had nonetheless obtained a large measure of such power. Coupled with the power he had obtained from his use within the city of federal money, it gave him considerable independence of the city's mayor. He was using forces outside the city to bend its highest elected official to his will. By employing forces outside the city's control, he was remaking the city in certain crucial areas without allowing the city any say in that remaking. Chapter 24. Driving. Always time had pursued Moses hotly. Now it panted at his very heels. His dream now was to remake a city, but the city itself would obviously never be able to finance its own remaking. Only the federal government possessed sufficient resources, and there was no guarantee that those resources would continue to be made available for the purpose. In fact, there was more reason to suppose that they would not, for every upswing in the economy brought a corresponding rise in the outcry for a cutback in work relief from the predominantly conservative press and from conservatives in Congress. The president, whose belief in the balanced budget was dying hard, continually wavered himself. In 1936, during another upswing, he ordered a stretch-out in the spending of already allocated work relief funds. Good news for the nation was therefore bad news for Moses. Every upswing in the economy spelled a downswing in his hopes. And the disappearance of CWA on 48 hours' notice in 1934 had taught him how quickly those hopes could be dashed altogether. Moses knew that the opportunity presented by the $4.8 billion WPA program might disappear at almost any time, and a similar opportunity might never present itself again. He couldn't allow anything or anybody in the city to stand in his way or to slow him down. And he used the same forces that were so effective in dealing with the city's mayor, influence with state and federal governments, immense personal popularity, tactics he had perfected on Long Island, to make sure that no one would. The rest of the city's government might have slowed him down. Obeying and following the complex laws and procedures set forth in the city's 3,000-page charter and administrative code would have slowed the pace of Moses' building. But the special powers he had written into the Park Department Unification Act exempted him from many of the charter's restrictions, and he ignored or circumvented most of the others. Under the Charter, for example, the design of every public structure had to be submitted to and approved by the Municipal Art Commission. Moses submitted the designs for his structures on the very day that their construction was beginning, so that by the time the commission got around to considering them, they were finished. That government's appointed officials, sworn to uphold a law that Moses was violating in spirit or letter, and determined to live up to their oath, might have slowed him down. But he didn't let them. His usual technique with an insufficiently compliant departmental official was to demand that he be fired. Moses would attempt to convince the department's commissioner to do so by confidentially revealing to him damaging personal information dug up by his bloodhounds. And if they hadn't been able to dig up any, Moses invented some. He insinuated, for example, that an assistant corporation counsel who had angered him with his refusal to proceed with a legal case against residents of land adjoining a park site was a drunk. On more than one occasion, this technique worked. If it did not, Moses simply stepped up the pressure another notch. He refused to deal with the official involved, or to allow any of his aides to deal with him. This tactic brought the relationship between the park department and the other department involved to a halt until the commissioner agreed to shift his offending subordinate to a post in which he did not have to deal with the park department and to replace him with a more amenable individual. It was a tactic that brought weak-spined commissioners to their knees in short order, and it even worked with Windles. The corporation council at first refused to fire or shift his drunk assistant, but Moses sent him a telegram stating, "I have given orders that no one is to discuss any matter under my jurisdiction with him." Windle sent back a telegram of his own. "The manner in which legal matters arising from the work of your department are to be handled by my department will be determined by me." But Moses refused to relent, and the corporation council realized that he could not allow park development to be stalled by a dispute over one individual. He shifted the assistant to another assignment. If a commissioner still resisted, Moses used the public rather than the private smear. "Mr. Moses told me that he was able to control the press of New York City so as to hold me up to such obloquy that I would not be able to stand it," W. Kingsland Macy had testified a decade before. The smear technique that had been used then was used now, frequently. In the hands of a man for whom the press acted as a gigantic sounding board, repeating and amplifying his words, the smear was a terrible weapon, particularly when those words were as caustic and cutting as Moses. At Yale, his poetry had revealed an undeniable gift for language. During the decades since Yale, Moses had turned this gift from imagery to invective, and that invective had been honed by years of use to an edge as cruelly sharp as that of a razor with a jagged edge. And he used that razor to strike straight for the jugular, not an opponent's issues or arguments, but his reputation. For most public men, prominent on the list of hurts that pierce the heart, that sear the soul, is the hurt of coming to the breakfast table one morning and seeing harsh black headlines call them fools or liars, or hack bureaucrats, or crooks, headlines based on charges by a man regarded as a genius who was always right, and followed by an article that made the charges seem true, even if they were false. Herbert Lehman's advisors had been able to laugh off Moses' smears because they were famous men with established reputations, and because Moses' accusations against them had been specific and therefore refutable by publication of the facts. But the minor officials on whom Moses now employed the smear technique were more vulnerable, particularly since Moses, having learned, perhaps, from the gubernatorial campaign, usually smeared now not with specific charges but with generalizations, with labels such as politician or bureaucrat that conjured up vague but unpleasant connotations in readers' minds, and which, being vague, were difficult to disprove, so difficult, in fact, that his victims were effectively denied recourse even to libel suits. Deputy Comptroller Douglas Mathewson, for example, was only doing his duty as legal advisor to the Sinking Fund Commission when he informed it in a memorandum that Moses' demand that it transfer to the Park Department a tract of land on Coney Island belonging to the Board of Education was illegal. The charter, Mathewson pointed out, clearly provided that the commission could make permanent transfers only subject to approval of the Board of Estimate, and that even the board could act only after formally asking all other city departments if they needed the property so that it could be guided in assigning land by an overall view of departmental needs. Unfortunately for Mathewson, however, while he believed that his memorandum was routine, it struck at the heart of Moses' method of operation. The park commissioner didn't want the Board of Estimate, or anyone else, taking an overall view of departmental needs, because if they did, they would realize that the park department was obtaining a wholly disproportionate share of city-owned land, and, more important, was obtaining land for which other departments were even then planning uses, as was, in fact, the case with the tract in question. The Board of Education was planning a badly needed school on the Coney Island site. Moses wanted to work, too fast for other departments to defend against his land raids, only through the malleable sinking fund commission. When, as the result of Mathewson's memo, the commission delayed action on Moses' request, and when Mathewson's boss, Comptroller McGoldrick, refused to obey Moses' demand that he fire his subordinate, Moses called in reporters. Telling them that the only questions involved were procedural, he said, "If Mathewson's theory is to prevail, politics would come in. Can you imagine when the public would have parks if they had to wait for all this red tape? Are the old hacks or red tape boys going to hold things up?" At the commission's next meeting, the transfers Moses wanted were quickly approved, with McGoldrick voting for them, and thereby against his subordinate. Mathewson sat through the meeting without a word. Shortly thereafter, the old hack and red tape boy quietly resigned, one of a score of minor officials publicly ridiculed and humiliated by Moses, and driven out of public service for no other reason than that they had tried to make him obey the law. If an official refused to resign and his boss refused to fire him, even after Moses' smear tactics had made him a political liability, there was still another notch on the Moses pressure gauge. The liability could be escalated. By 1935, this was easy, for 1935 marked the height of nationwide hysteria over the Red Peril. William Randolph Hearst was hoarsely alerting America to the infiltration of the White House by liberal professors who had made the New Deal more communistic than the communists. Operatives of the demagogue publisher's Journal American were posing as Columbia University students to entrap professors into radical remarks. The House Un-American Activities Committee was probing WPA theater projects. "Now, this Christopher Marlowe," demanded the Honorable Joe Starnes of Alabama, "is he a communist type too?" And when Diego Rivera refused to remove from his mural in the gleaming new lobby of Rockefeller Center a likeness of Lenin glaring down on a scene of American police clubbing strikers, young Nelson Rockefeller ordered the artist down off his scaffold, handed him a check to wind up his contract, and had the half-finished work covered with tar paper. And the nation's hysteria provided Moses with a new set of labels: commie, bolshie, pinko, left-winger, more damning in the American public consciousness than even hack politician or red tape boy, and therefore, in the arsenal of the smear, perhaps the ultimate weapon. Moses applied these labels generously, branding them not only onto labor leaders, radical left-wing, and New Deal brain trusters, Rexford Tugwell he assailed as a planning red, and urban planners who dared to offer suggestions for the future of New York City, regarded in Russia as our greatest builder, was how he characterized Frank Lloyd Wright. He called Lewis Mumford an outspoken revolutionary. Walter Gropius, he said, was seeking to change the American system by advocating a philosophy which doesn't belong here. Planners in general, he said, are socialists, revolutionaries, who do not reach the masses directly but through familiar subsurface activity. They teach the teachers. They reach people in high places, who in turn influence the press, universities, societies, learned and otherwise, radio networks, the stage, the screen. But onto youthful city officials who dared to stand up to him, and who had, his bloodhounds discovered, once allowed enthusiasm and naivete to lead them into membership in some organization that they later learned was a communist front. His enthusiasm for these labels was based in part on his conservative belief in the necessity for class distinctions. To a man who had believed the trade unions of Mr. Walling